So the Ginsburg-Landau equation that's shown up there is probably familiar to most of you. And coming from the chemistry department, it's a very good model for reaction diffusion equations near the Hopf bifurcation point. So it's the normal form equation for the onset of describing the onset of oscillations in a spatially distributed system. So A is a complex amplitude field that we can actually relate to chemical concentrations in a real system. So it's much more convenient for somebody like me to deal with this equation than with the rather ugly equations that chemistry gives you. But hopefully some of the features that derive from this equation can apply to real systems, such as those that are encountered in cardiac arrhythmias and so forth. So what I want to describe today is just some very specific aspects of spiral waves in these systems. And in particular, I should warn you that a lot of the results that I'll present are numerical in character, but they actually suggest some problems that we don't know how to solve. And so perhaps maybe some of you can tell me how to solve them. So let me begin. Most of the talk is devoted to three-dimensional media. In fact, all of the talk, with the exception of this slide, is devoted to three-dimensional media. And to introduce it and to form the background, I want to just say a few words about spiral waves in the complex Ginsburg-Landau equation. So you see a picture of one there. We don't actually know how to solve the Ginsburg-Landau equation analytically for this spiral wave solution, but we do know its form, which I've written down here. And we know the properties of the functions f and psi, and their asymptotic properties. And for our purposes, we just need to know that the solution exists and that we can determine its properties in terms of the asymptotic wave number k sub s and the corresponding spiral wave frequency, which I can't really control this hand very well. Should have a pointer. any rate, the spiral wave frequency omega sub s. The other quantity that I wanted to mention that will play a role in what I'm talking about is the topological charge. So in the spiral wave, it's the spiral core that organizes the dynamics. The core is a defect in the system where both the amplitude and phase of the complex field A vanish. And if you take the line integral around the core of the gradient of the phase, that defines what's called the topological charge sigma. And for the CGL system, sigma equals plus or minus 1 is the corresponds to the stable spiral waves that you find in the system. This is the two-dimensional case, yeah. So this is the background. And what I want to do is now focus on the three-dimensional case, where we now imagine stacking a set of these two-dimensional spirals, just as I've done in the picture. And now if you draw out the core of the spiral wave, the topological defect, it becomes a line in three-dimensional space. And it's the characteristics of this line that I want to study in most of the rest of the talk. So just to introduce some notation, the line is a space curve that I'll call x. And as is usual, you characterize it by the tangent, normal, and binormal vectors. And they satisfy the Frenet-Serret equations. So the quantities that are going to be important here are primarily, well, the curvature and the torsion, tau, that I'll introduce later. So given this filament, the core of the spiral wave in three-dimensional space, described as a curve, I want to mention one other property that we have to consider when thinking about these filaments in the complex Ginsburg-Landau equation. In addition to thinking about the core of the spiral wave being a line, we also have to worry about the fact that we have a phase field in the system. And so the phase field can actually twist around the filament. And so in the picture that I've drawn here, you see that the phase field rotates around the central filament defined by the core. And so we really have to talk about ribbons instead of just lines. And so the notation I'm using is that the field V that defines the phase makes some angle with the Frenet ribbon, which is defined by the way B rotates around the line filament. So a little more specifically, we have some line segment defined by the core and a corresponding outer edge of the ribbon curve defined by a vector V that makes an angle phi with the binormal vector. And then we can determine the local rate at which the vector V twists around the central line of the filament, and that defines for us the local twist rate, omega. And this can be decomposed into the twist of the filament itself, which is just given by the Frenet equations, and the twist of the ribbon around the binormal. So we decompose the local twist rate into the twist of the ribbon and the twist of the filament. And so the twist is just the rate of change of the binormal with the arc length. So the other bit of background that I need to characterize these equations are the twist, link, and writhe. So I'm going to be talking about three-dimensional solutions of the complex Ginzburg-Landau equations, where I use specific boundary conditions on the sides that I'll tell you about, but periodic boundary conditions along Z, the way the filament is oriented. So that means we actually have a closed ribbon curve. And for a closed ribbon curve, we can then talk about the total twist, which is just the integral of the twist that I described for you earlier. So I've, again, decomposed it now into the total twist of the filament, which is given by the integral of the torsion along the curve, and the ribbon twist, which is just the integral of this phase field phi. The link number is just the number of sine crossings of this ribbon curve. And finally, the writhe gives us the measure of whether it's a planar curve or not. So this is the Gauss-like formula for the writhe. And finally, the three of these are related by White's theorem, which relates the link to the sum of the twist and the writhe. And this condition now imposes constraints on the types of things that can happen to this filament. And this will be an important relation in what follows. Okay, so now let me get down to the actual work. So, as I said before, I want you to imagine a box, a three-dimensional box with periodic boundary conditions along Z and boundary conditions on the side, which are basically the most neutral boundary conditions that we can supply to the system. The boundary conditions are such that we assume that far from the spiral, it behaves, the waves are basically plane waves and they exit the system. So if you have a finite size box, then the link is conserved because it's just the number of times the phase field twists and you're linking it on itself, so it's a quantized quantity. And you can define a quantity gamma, which is just the link number divided by the length of the filament. And that'll be one of the bifurcation parameters in the system. So the idea is that we take the filament, we apply twist to it in some initial condition, and because of the conservation law, that's a given amount of twist that's in the system, and then we can ask, how does the filament bifurcate? What happens to the filament for a given amount of twist applied to it? So in one regime, it's easy to actually get a solution for this equation. If you apply a little bit of twist to the filament remains straight, and for a straight filament with a given amount of twist, gamma, you can write down the solution just in terms of the two-dimensional spiral wave solution. And you can see that the phase field just has a twist applied to it, and simple scaling shows you that it takes exactly the same form as the two-dimensional spiral wave solution, but with a scaled position. And the scaling is just given by the twist. And also the frequency of the twisted spiral solutions are different from the standard spirals. There again, they change because of this dependence on the twist, the local twist. But basically, it's just a straight filament, and you know the solution given the fact that you know the functions f and psi, which you know numerically and by matched asymptotics for the two-dimensional solution. So this is easy, and for a straight twisted filament, the twist of the filament is zero, and there's no writhe, and so the linking number is equal to the twist of the ribbon for this case. So the question that we want to ask now, what happens if you increase the twist on the system? And so the first thing that happens is shown here. This is not a artist's drawing. This is the actual filament in a simulation of the three-dimensional complex Ginzburg-Landau equation in a really big system. This is 2,048 lattice units high and 128 squared on a side. This took a lot of time to compute. And so this is the filament that you extract from the numerical simulation, and it bifurcates to a helix. This is, if you think of elastic rods or your telephone cable, this is exactly what you expect to happen when you apply twist to a rod. If you twist it enough, it bifurcates into a helix. And that's the z-axis is horizontal now. Yeah. The straight solution has become linearly unstable, and this is the stable solution of the Ginzburg-Landau equation. So there's a as I'll show in the next transparency, there's a critical value of the twist density where the straight solution becomes unstable and bifurcates to this solution.
And so this you found this by computing the Ginzburg-Landau equation for a twist
which
was above the
critical.
Exactly.
Why do you have so many curves?
Yeah, you'll see why we did this. This is, of course, for this problem, it's a complete overkill because I have something like I don't know how many, but it looks like on the order of 600 or 700 turns of the helix. You could do it in a very small box for a couple of turns for this particular bifurcation. Yes, yes. That's right. Each of these is a scroll wave. Around. So what you're looking at is just the filament, not the phase field. We did it in this size box because I'll show you, excuse me, other bifurcations later on where we actually need the big spatial scale. So just a few other comments about this solution. I'm calling lambda h the pitch of the helix, and so you can define a quantity gamma h, which is just 2 pi over lambda. And the interesting thing is that gamma h is not equal to gamma. So in other words, if you apply a certain local twist to the system, you don't get as many turns of the helix as turns of the phase twist that you apply to the system. They're different. The system readjusts to give you a different value of the pitch relative to the pitch that you would get from just the phase twist of the ribbon. And the helix is actually rotating, so it rotates either with plus angular velocity or minus angular velocity, so it's like a corkscrew rotating in the system with angular velocity omega. So for a helical solution, you can actually analyze the components of the twist, link, and writhe easily. And since for a helix, the curvature and the twist are constant along the filament, so the important relation is this one here. It shows that the twist divided by the link is 1 minus the gamma quantity related to the pitch of the helix divided by gamma, the local twist density that you apply to the filament. And for the result that I just showed you there, gamma h is bigger than gamma, which means that the twist of the ribbon is negative. So you apply twist, And once the thing bifurcates to a helix, which introduces writhe, the writhe is compensated by a negative ribbon twist. And that's a consequence, I mean, it's a consequence of White's theorem, basically, for the system, if that happens, for this, if the pitch has that value. Now, I just want to say a few words about how we actually get some of the results for the helical solution. You can imagine that these simulations of the 3D Ginzburg-Landau equation are fairly painful. For the helix, you can actually study the bifurcation structure by using a two-dimensional equation. So what you observe in the 3D simulations, that both in the transient and in the final state, the helical symmetry is preserved. So you can assume the helical symmetry of the solution given here with a given pitch of the helix given by these quantities. And then you can substitute it into the Ginzburg-Landau equation and derive a two-dimensional Ginzburg-Landau equation now. Now, there are a couple of interesting things about the 2D Ginzburg-Landau equation for the helix. One is technical. Even though you're dealing with the two-dimensional equation, you have terms like this involving the second derivative with respect to the angular variable. And it's a fairly nasty equation to integrate numerically. So you can't just do it simply. We had to actually use variable time steps and variable spatial grids in polar coordinates to integrate it accurately. The more interesting aspect is that in this equation, you see this quantity gamma related to the pitch of the helix appearing, and gamma r, which is just really the excess twist. So the gamma that you apply to the phase field minus the gamma of the helix. So there are actually two independent bifurcation parameters in this equation, gamma and gamma h. You don't know them. You put them in. And so what you have to do is actually, if you're interested in studying the bifurcations as a function of gamma, the applied twist, then you have to solve this equation for fixed gamma for a variety of gamma h and look for the instability in order to determine the diagram. But since it's a 2D equation, it's much easier to solve. So this is just a typical way we analyze the equation. As I said before, gamma and gamma h are independent parameters. So you can Fourier analyze the B field of the helix and look for the instability just by looking for the real part of the eigenvalue associated with the modes of that Fourier decomposition. And a typical the typical behavior of the eigenvalue as a function of gamma h, which is our parameter, for a fixed value of twist applied to the system, you generate diagrams that look like this. And what you see is that there appear to be two branches to the mode structure of the system. This central branch actually corresponds to delocalized solutions. So the eigenvectors corresponding to these eigenvalues correspond to delocalized solutions. I have a picture of that here. So if you look at, say, A0 or B0, the Fourier components of the B field, then you can see that as a function of R, the radius distance away from the central filament, the modes are completely delocalized. They grow. And these actually are the modes of the straight filament. And you can see that they correspond to basically neutrally stable solutions here. The modes corresponding to these eigenvalues are localized. They're shown here. So they're localized in R. And these are the modes that actually give rise to the instability of the helix bifurcation. So basically what we do is we vary gamma and construct diagrams like this and look for the instability, the value of gamma h at which the instability occurs.
Once again, what are the terms here?
Okay, so these are plots of the eigenvalues as a function of gamma h, the independent parameter, the pitch of the helix. So for a fixed value of twist applied, we look at the most unstable modes for a given value of the pitch of the helix, and we trace it out as a function of the pitch of the
helix.
Oh, okay. So they're described here. Whoops. They're described here. We're extracting the coefficients. Pardon? We physically compute the field. We numerically compute the field. Then we Fourier analyze it to find this solution. So that they're of course coupled, but we Fourier analyze the result that we get from the numerical solution. This lambda is the one for the most unstable mode that we find in the system. So we can also get this by looking at the growth of the radius, actually, because that will also give you the most unstable mode. That mode is easy to pick out because it determines the instability. That's right. And we're looking at the harmonic that corresponds to the fastest growth rate in the system. That's the approximation we're making. If you.
So if that's the most unstable mode, then you're seeing that for gamma h sufficiently large, it's actually linearly stable.
That's right. So there's a band. So what it says is that there's a for this value of gamma h, there's a band of gamma. For this value of gamma, there's a band of gamma h where there's a stable helix, and now the nonlinear terms will select the helix in that band. It's a typical nonlinear selection, pattern selection problem.
So each of these corresponds to the most unstable perturbation for that particular.
Yes, that's right. So this is not the nonlinear analysis. So for this particular value, you don't know which one is going to be selected. So by collecting that data and actually now looking for the bifurcation point in gamma, you can construct a bifurcation diagram that gives the radius of the helix versus the twist applied to the system. And so what this data suggests, in particular the plot of R squared against gamma, is that it's a supercritical Hopf bifurcation to a helix. And so and you could extract the critical value, which is given there for these particular parameter values.
Sorry to interrupt you all the time. We understood the depend very much on the vorticity of the space, on the quantum number you mentioned at the very beginning.
That's right.
Binding number for the
space. You mean the initial twist I apply? Or?
No, binding number for the.
We start with a straight helix. We oppose a given phase twist to the system, which is gamma, and then we let the system select gamma h.
I understand. For the system, you need a top-level charge plus or minus 1.
Sorry?
This is the
top-level
charge. The
total
charge is either plus or minus 1.
Right. We start with the ansatz that, we start with the known fact that for the 2D CGL, the stable solutions have topological charge plus or minus 1. Okay, so just one other observation about this. If you now plot the writhe against the twist, then you see that at least for small twist rates, the writhe varies linearly with the twist, and this is exactly like an elastic rod. So up to this point, the vortex filament and the CGL equation is behaving just like an elastic rod. You apply twist to it at a given value, it bifurcates into a helix, and the ride that you get is proportional to the twist that you apply to the system. So it's a nice analogy. Okay, so now let's go further. You keep cranking up the twist on the system, and what you see next is also what your telephone line does, which is it generates a superhelix. So you can see that there's obviously a big coil with little coils in it as well. And here we can't use the two-dimensional solution. We have to really just compute the three-dimensional complex Ginzburg-Landau equation, so we don't have as many points. But it's suggestive of a Hopf bifurcation giving rise to this transition. And I'll say a few more words about this superhelix solution. So this is another representation of the dynamics in space and time. So space is along the abscissa, and time moves downward along the ordinate. And what we do is, so what you're actually seeing to get the color coding right is you're looking at this particular phase field, the phase field associated with, the angle associated with the position of the helical filament, and it's convenient just to color code it this way. It makes the turns of the helix stand out. Any rate, so what you're seeing here is the evolution to the superhelix state starting from an initial helix. And so I've indicated here the pitch of the helix, which you can see just by the distance between the lines, and the velocity at which the screw is turning, v. And so you can see in these lines the pitch and the velocity. So the superhelix develops. So time. So the twist is such that the superhelical solution is stable, but the initial condition is just the helix. So you're seeing the transient, how the superhelix evolves to the superhelix. The x-axis is z. Yeah. So this is the helix. So you can see how many turns we have, quite a lot in this system. And then you can see at a given time the superhelix develops. Those are these big bumps. But what's interesting is that so the superhelix has again a given pitch and velocity at which it turns, but the little turns of the superhelix, which are lambda 1 and v1 for the velocity, are different from the original helix that you started from. So it's, you know, both frequencies change. So this is like a quasi-periodic solution because you have two independent frequencies coming into play for this solution. So both the pitch and the angular velocity change when you make this bifurcation.
You change
from the previous phase, the previous picture
was the twist, which is an integer.
Yes, the twist is an integer.
So instead of an initial phase field number, and what integer is it?
I think the pitch is something like 5.5 times 2 pi over 128 or something like that. I forget the units now, but the you can see it here in these gamma units, the local twist. So the twist, total twist divided by the length, is 5. So that means per unit length, there are basically 5 turns of the phase field.
And
the length is 2,000. Yes, that's right. There may be factors of 2 pi missing because it doesn't look like quite that much. I think there are the factors of 2 pi missing. So it's something like 5 divided by 2 pi turns per unit length in the system. So it's something like 2,000 turns. Yeah, right, right. That's correct.
And then you took one of those profiles from gamma equals
Yeah, we did it both ways. This picture that I showed you is doing exactly that, just to show the evolution of the superhelix. We also did it by starting from the straight filament and then looking at the bifurcation. So we checked the initial condition as well. R is the radius of the helix.
So can we see that in the next transparency? Are we seeing that R anywhere?
Oops. This one. No, you're not seeing R. You're seeing bits of R, right? This is the X and Y are the X and Y coordinates of the filament. So this is relative to the center of the filament, and so it has a given radius and a phase. I mean, we're just expressing it in polar coordinates, rather, right? And I'm just plotting phi. And this is just one representation of that. Here. That's exactly my point. They are. They're different. The small turns, the helical turns in the superhelix, actually change their character when you are in the superhelical state. They're not the same as the original helix. So you generate two genuine independent frequencies for this. Yeah, that's right.
And that even though they're not propagating along the axis, they're propagating along the other piece. So actually they're going even more fast.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's exactly right, yeah. Okay. All right. So next. Now we want to do more twist on the system. So what happens next? Any guesses? What happens to your telephone cord? Right. Normally you would get plectonemic rise in the system, but there's a problem with vortex filaments because remember, in any cross section through this filament, you have a spiral wave. And so you have to globally have the phase field connect properly. So it's not very good to have the filament sheets clash with themselves. But it does its best, and this is what you get, actually, when you crank it up. So you get localized solutions of this type, where you have, so there are again two representations. This is the same representation that I showed you in the last picture, where we're plotting this field phi versus space and time. And this is easier to see. So you have primarily a helical filament, but with a localized superhelical segment in the filament. And you get other structures like this involving more localized segments. In this case, there are three of them. And this begins to present some puzzles because if you actually look at the number of localized objects on average that you get from such simulations versus the twist that you apply to the system, then for a high amount of twist, you have a large number of localized objects. And for a smaller amount of twist, you have fewer localized objects. But it seems that these, if you decrease the twist up to the superhelical bifurcation point, this is where the number of localized objects disappear. So what that means is that if I go back to this diagram, that things are not so simple here, that all of these localized solutions actually coexist with the superhelical solution as well. So this must be some type of subcritical bifurcation for this system. So the bifurcations are fairly complicated at this stage, and we don't really know how to analyze those in detail at this point. So looking at these local bifurcations in a little more detail, there's an interesting observation that you can make. It's possible to write the ride in a local form by basically making reference to some a reference curve, in which case, in this case, we just take the straight filament as the reference curve. And so you can, with regard to that reference curve, for which the ride is zero since it's a straight filament, you can write this local version of the ride using Buller's theorem. And so that means you can actually write a local version of White's theorem for the filament. And so we can get a local expression for the twist in terms of the torsion, this phi, the ribbon twist, and now this local version of the ride. So using the ride that we know and computing gamma from this formula, you can plot gamma locally, which is normally a global object, global quantity, as a function of distance along the z-axis. And you can see that the local value of the twist is very high at exactly the points where the localized segments occur. So there are these two dotted lines in this picture. The upper dotted line is just the average twist in the system, and the lower dotted line is the critical value of the twist where the superhelical bifurcation occurs. And so you can see that in these regions, you exceed the bifurcation point, and you get these local regions of superhelical segments, and the other places, it's below this bifurcation or close to it, and so you get helical segments. So it's a complicated story, and we don't really fully understand how all of these solutions fit together. Just a couple of other comments about this. So far I've talked about taking a straight filament for all of this is done for one set of parameter values in the complex Ginzburg-Landau equation. So we're just sitting someplace in the parameter space of the complex Ginzburg-Landau equation that supports a nice spiral wave solution, and the solutions are stable and so forth. So you can ask the question, if you take a straight filament now with no twist, and imagine now moving the a straight film with twist. So you remember that I had, at the very beginning of the talk, I said you could apply a small amount of twist to a straight film and it would remain straight. You would just get a renormalization of the frequency and wave vector of the spiral wave. So that was for a fixed value of the Ginzburg-Landau parameters. So now you can imagine taking that same straight filament with a given amount of twist and now changing the parameters and asking what happens. Is it always stable in the parameter space? And the answer is no, that as you move around, you get near what's called the core instability for the 2D Ginzburg-Landau equation. That's a region in parameter space where the core just begins to accelerate in the system. And in the 3D case, there is a corresponding curve. In fact, there's a family of curves, one each for every given value of the twist, where the straight filament bifurcates. And if you look at the way it bifurcates, it appears to bifurcate to a helix, but the helix continues to grow. It never saturates. So on the right-hand side, I've shown you for some particular set of parameters and twist that the helix actually saturates to a given value, close to 4 for the radius. But on the left, for the same amount of twist, just changing the Ginzburg-Landau parameters alpha and beta, you now get a solution that grows, and it grows until it reaches the sides of our box. And so there's no evidence of saturation. We've done this for larger system sizes and so forth. So there are these exploding solutions in different regions of the parameter space. As I say, we don't really know that. We can't know that from simulations. We've done it for larger boxes than what's shown here, and there's no evidence of saturation, but we can never be sure. Whatever happens very, very quickly. We can't seem to refine our parameter space to actually capture. It's either bound or unbound. There's seems to be a genuine bifurcation boundary to an exploded solution. Okay, how much time do I have? 5 minutes or 8 minutes? So I can either stop here, or I can give you a short view of Dolman's, not in the Ginzburg-Landau equation, but in the Fitzy-Nagumo equation in 3D. Do you have a lot of questions, or should I? Yeah.
You reminded us that there actually are these spiral things, not together.
Right.
And then I realized I can't see how they fit together. So if you took a vertical slice, you'd have two spirals, two terms of helix.
For the superhelix?
No, for the regular helix.
Yeah, okay.
If you take a vertical slice and look at two of the crossings.
So by vertical, do you mean perpendicular to the filament or
perpendicular?
Oh, yeah. No, what you have to think of is,
how am I going to join those two spirals?
Okay, what you have to think of, so in the straight filament, you simply stack the spirals, right? So for a straight, you just have a 2D spiral, you take a cut normal to the filament, and it looks like a spiral wave. So now you stack them up in 3D, so there's no problem. So when the helical bifurcation occurs, you have to imagine displacing the centers of the spirals by a bit. So the spirals are now actually wobbling. They're not sitting in the same spot. The spirals are wobbling, and they're shooting out waves that are distorting the phase field. And that's how they're able to stack together. So they're displaced, and the spiral arms are also distorted so that the phase field can join smoothly. Yeah. Right. So you'll see waves being shot out in sort of like almost a zigzag pattern.
So
there's
not really a space to keep in that.
Oh yes. Yeah. It's an oscillatory medium, so it's shooting out waves all of the time. They're stationary in a co-moving frame for the ordinary spirals, right? If you're in a frame that's rotating with the spiral period, then it's a stationary solution. But in the helical solution, you have another frequency to deal with. Yes. And in the case of this superhelix, it's a quasi-periodic solution. Well, the center of the spiral is a source of waves for this system. It's winding. So the waves are
okay. By waves, you don't mean there's something which take energy from the
channel. No, these are phase waves.
You really mean waves along that direction?
Well, for the helix, the waves are going along Z, but the waves are also moving in the XY plane as well. It comes back to the first picture I showed. Here. Far enough away from the spiral, they are plane waves.
Okay, then
In which case?
If you have plane wave going off.
Oh no, it's a wave bifurcation. It's a wave bifurcation. It's not the normal type of Hopf bifurcation. It is a wave bifurcation for sure.
So in principle, you have your solution is not like a line.
Not like a.
Not like a
That's right. That's right.
You have a core, well, left.
That's
core,
right. Exactly. Exactly.
Think about this as a long living stationary solution.
Right.
Your solution for a very long lifetime.
Yeah. Okay.
But potentially, you can break the part and go.
Yeah.
If you allow yourself an infinite volume.
Yeah, infinite, then it's exactly. It's plane waves being just.
You need a special boundary condition. You can tell us that.
Okay. Yes. So, in fact, what it turned out that these bifurcations were very sensitive to the type of boundary conditions that you used. If you use the typical no-flux boundary conditions for the system, then you have to go to very large system sizes to minimize the effect of the bifurcation, of the boundaries on the bifurcation point. So what we did was to make use of the fact that far enough from the spiral, the system is essentially shooting out plane waves, and then we used a boundary condition that says plane waves exit from the system. And those were quite neutral to the calculation. And so, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Glue it together with the boundary conditions, yeah. Okay, so I don't know if it's worth, I think probably it's not worth talking about this. I'll just say in words what's it here. A lot of the motivation for work like this is some problems that we encounter. Typically, one of the favorite ones in the field is to work on cardiac arrhythmias, where normally you're dealing with excitable media, but oscillatory media are also interesting to study in this context. And we've done basically some studies of vortex filaments in spherical geometries. So this is a solid sphere of material, and if you now select initial conditions, which are these wedge-like initial conditions for in the phase field, you can generate spirals. This is a picture of the spiral. Spiral is really a scroll wave. It exists inside the sphere, and there's a vortex filament connecting this north pole with the south pole. And then you can ask, how does the filament bifurcate in the system? And now there are additional constraints because the topological charge has to be conserved on this closed surface, and so you can ask questions about how the filament bifurcates. And the topology is not exactly like a heart, but it's closer to to a heart than the geometries I showed you before. So, yes, this is why you actually see the hole here. So these are, most of the study actually dealt with spherical shells, and then we actually put holes in them as well. But, yeah, so I was going to just talk about the solid sphere work, but then you actually have a vortex filament connecting here and here, and then another one someplace else, and then you can ask about the dynamics of those bits of. The thickness of the heart plays a serious role. It's believed that all of the electrochemical waves, well, it's not believed, all the electrochemical waves are really scroll waves, they're three-dimensional waves. And, but more importantly, at least it's believed that at least some of the mechanisms for the appearance of atrial fibrillation have to do with the bifurcations of the filament itself, so the three-dimensional character, which is why one is interested in what these filaments do. In addition, heart tissue is very inhomogeneous, and there's actually the way the muscle fibers are oriented gives a twist to the filaments as well. And so these filaments tend to twist, and you can actually look at NMR images of some of the waves, and you see twisted filaments. And so this is part of the background for the study of these problems. But I'll stop here.